Welcome to Interchange. I'm Doug Storm. Our opening song is Ode to the Big Sea by the Cinematic Orchestra off the 1999 album Motion, where songs are built with wave upon wave of repeated loops and instrumental phrases. Our use of cinematic orchestra throughout also repeats. Our show today is Shooting the Gulf, Alan Sekula in the American Grain. In his most famous essay, Self-Reliance, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote perhaps his most famous sentences. Life only avails, not the having lived. Power ceases in the instant of repose. It resides in the moment of transition from a past to a new state, in the shooting of the gulf, in the darting to an aim. Alan Sekula was an American photographer, writer, filmmaker, theorist, and critic whose work frequently focused on what he called the imaginary and material geographies of the advanced capitalist world. Sekula started and maintained a photographic and literary praxis for 40 years. What you see in his 2012 essay film, made in collaboration with film theorist Noel Birch, The Forgotten Space, is predicated on the same principles laid out in his aerospace folktales, first exhibited at the University of California at San Diego in 1973. Perhaps the key difference being that aerospace folktales is described as a disassembled movie, while The Forgotten Space is, of course, assembled. I'm sure you can already detect the analogies that connect the themes and subjects of Sekula's work in the word assemble, as we apply it to industry and labor and the material things that profit some small number of the humans on this planet. We might think of Sekula's work as a kind of investigation of Melville's monkey rope, what binds us to each other across the gap. A mate is attached to the harpooner as the latter, now become butcher, cuts into whale flesh, stripping away its life for the commodity that lighted the night of the 19th century. What binds us in the service of profit-seeking entities? Melville is a kind of guiding intelligence throughout Sekula's work as he examines laboring humans on ships and in ports and the consequences of that labor to the humans that perform it, as well as the geographies maimed and destroyed by its economic dictates. Alan Sekula was born in 1951 in Erie, Pennsylvania, though spending most of his life in and around Los Angeles. He died in August 2013 of gastric esophageal cancer at the age of 62. Sekula's vision and his voice is impressively global and yet always local. The sites he explores are always uniquely of their place, but they are always also contending with the same economic tyrannies. But Sekula was more than a critic of capitalism. He was an influential theorist of documentary photography and photojournalism. And for today's show, we'll discover the intersection of these interests. His 2003 book, Titanic's Wake, is a great introduction to both of these modes. If you want to dive deeper, find his Photography Against the Grain and brace yourself. Through an investigation of the uses of photography by capitalist state institutions, like museums and the CIA, and even the public school system, Sekula exposes fully the manipulations of class and economic ideology. Today, though, we'll need to tighten our focus with the help of guest Stephanie Schwartz, a lecturer in American documentary film and photography and American modernism at University College London. She recently published a special In Focus project for the Tate Modern, part of an institution that houses the United Kingdom's National Collection of British Art and International Modern and Contemporary Art. Irony is always abound in capitalism. Tate is named after Henry Tate, a sugar magnate whose refineries were located along the Thames River in Liverpool and Silvertown. Schwartz focuses on Sekula's Waiting for Tear Gas, his anti-journalistic manifesto consisting of a looped slide sequence of 81 photographs shot among the crowds during the anti-World Trade Organization protests in Seattle, Washington in 1999. The work is a radical form of portraiture and street photography, critique of the journalistic photo essay and a profound anti-capitalist statement. Shooting the Gulf, Alan Sekula in The American Great.
In an obituary essay I read, basically also points out that the book Photography Against the Grain, significantly altered the way in which the documentary function of photography was conceptualized. Do you mind helping me understand that a little bit? What's that alteration? How was it before that point? And what did Sekula bring to it?
So I'm probably referring to an essay that he wrote that was published in that book, but appeared in several different publications, kind of earlier versions of it in 78, 79, called Dismantling Modernism.
Dismantling Modernism, 1978. I am arguing then for an art that documents monopoly capitalism's inability to deliver the conditions of a fully human life, for an art that recalls Benjamin's remark in the Theses on the Philosophy of History that there is no document of civilization that is not at the same time a document of barbarism. Against violence directed at the human body, at the environment, at working people's ability to control their own lives, we need to counterpose an active resistance, simultaneously political and symbolic, to monopoly capitalism's increasing power and arrogance, a resistance aimed ultimately at socialist transformation. A didactic and critical representation is a necessary but insufficient condition for the transformation of society. A larger, encompassing praxis is necessary.
That is a kind of foundational text, and one of the things that I think I always kind of think about that text is that again goes back to some of the things that you were saying before, is that it's definitely a text that was written of its moment. It has the tone and tenor of a manifesto, and the way in which he's writing that comes from a kind of sense of urgency in the 70s that he, you know, that comes from the photographs and that he wants to bring back to kind of histories of photography. But I think the key term also that he's addressing there is this idea of dismantling modernism. And so it is about this idea of writing history and rewriting history. And we have a certain conception of what modernism is and where documentary might fit into that. And how do we kind of dismantle that and rewrite it? And one of the things that he's really responding to, and this cuts across Photography Against the Grain, is the way in which photography has been was being institutionalized, specifically in museums like the Museum of Modern Art, but also academically as a kind of art object. And one of the really important aspects of his work, and when he decided, you know, to commit to photography as well, was to think of photography as something that operates, you know, in culture in ways that art, fine art objects don't. And so he was thinking about the way in which it was being institutionalized, and specifically the way documentary was being institutionalized. And one of the kind of dialogues he's having in that text is with curators at the Museum of Modern Art, specifically one famous curator, John Sarkowski, who in 1967 put on a very famous show that many people responded to called New Documentary, in which he showcased the work of three photographers, Diane Arbus, Gary Winogrand, and Lee Friedlander, setting up this idea of a kind of refusal or kind of response to the, you know, 1930s documentary, and thinking about documentary now as a kind of personal poetics as opposed to a political endeavor. And he was responding to that way in which documentary was being institutionalized, as well as the way in which someone like Edward Steichen, who was the previous curator at the Museum of Modern Art, had put on a series of exhibitions as well around documentary photography. One of them that's important that doesn't, you know, get discussed that much is a show that he did in 1962 called The Bitter Years, in which he rehung, or he basically took the FSA archive, the Farm Security Administration archive, and used it in this way to script this narrative about, how now is this time that we've, you know, triumphed after the depression, it's over and we're entering this new, it was this kind of, you know, triumphal history of American struggle and success. And so Sekula was, you know, not just responding to documentary photography, but really responding to the way in which people were being trained to think about the agenda of documentary photography and really pushing back against that. Although it often gets written or discussed as being very critical of 30s documentary photography, but I would argue that that's not really what he's doing. What he's being critical is the way in which that has been historicized.
An important thing to point out, or to continue to try to understand, is how historicization works, right? How it is that we are trained, how it is that we come to have understanding of the past. And this is, you know, a sort of a front lines fight in some ways with Sekula, where he's constantly trying to suggest that these things have to always be struggled against, the actual framing of the story that you say. I think, you know, he recognizes his stories are fictions too, or fish stories.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
But he's critical of it. You know, he's aware of it. He's critical of it. He suggests you critique it as well, and constantly calling allusions to other fish stories, artists, authors, to keep the mind in that sort of fecund space of analogy and sort of push-pull antagonism of what the world is really doing.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's, you know, one of the great offerings of his work is that lesson of kind of thinking about how histories are written and how they need to be rewritten constantly. And so Forgotten Space is again, to go back to that one example of the kind of myth we have about the way in which people labor now, this kind of immaterialization of labor or this kind of freeing up of labor that you get to work, you know, wherever you want, you can invent your jobs, all of these kinds of very positive narratives about the way in which people work, which, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, they're not true, but he's not just interested in that. He's really interested in pointing, how do those stories get told? How do they get written so that they appear to be true? And so, yeah, one of the things I always think is important to stress is that, you know, it's not about just necessarily debunking certain myths, but looking at the political valences of the myths in place and how they were used and how they are continued to be used, what histories they block from coming to bear, you know, coming to be, and what histories they produce, and really working in those spaces between those different kinds of stories.
It's time for a break. Our song is All Things from the Cinematic Orchestra. More on Alan Sekula's art and activism when Interchange returns. Welcome back to Interchange. Today's show just barely breaks the surface of the fathoms deep work of photographer, essayist, and activist Alan Sekula. Our guest is Stephanie Schwartz, whose recent In Focus project for the Tate looks at Alan Sekula's slide installation, Waiting for Tear Gas.
The particular focus, Waiting for Tear Gas, as you can give us a little bit of the history of that work and how it comes out of that kind of resurgence, a moment in time that begins to be, I guess, move into the public imaginary, protest really past the civil rights era, kind of disappeared, or at least in my understanding of it, protest went dark in many ways, and perhaps the Seattle protests against the WTO became, you know, protests became more public again, if I'm reading that correctly.
Yeah, there's several different kind of ways to get into that this work. And, you know, obviously, again, it's kind of which history you want to write. I mean, he sets that up for you as well, I think, in mm-hmm. that work. Where are you going to place this? What is this work going to read to you? What is it going to do for you? Because he's jockeying here, as I talk about, with the media's representation of both protest and the protester.
Mm-hmm. So quickly set up the actual, subject of Waiting for Tear Gas.
Right. So Waiting for Tear Gas is a work that he did in which he was basically on the streets in Seattle during the anti-WTO World Trade Center protest that took place on over several days at the end of November, the beginning of December 1999. And so one of the big aspects of this work that is that he was in the street taking the photographs, walking with the protesters. So he was in the street working, taking these photographs. And this project actually comes out of, or I wouldn't necessarily comes out of, but it's in ways it is a continuation of the work that he was doing for Fish Story. I mean, all of his, that work, which is also a kind of precursor in a way to Forgotten Space around shipping and the work at sea, in relation to who he met during his travels. And obviously the port city and Seattle was part of that history. And so he spends, interestingly, he doesn't try to get the whole protest. He's not interesting. He won't kind of accept this myth that there is, that you could grasp the whole thing. You could have a totality. If you stood there for the full days of the protest, you would have coverage of it. He spends one day, basically, as he says in a text that he writes to go along with it, from dawn to dusk, taking this series of photographs. He purposely does it in a way that is what he calls anti-photojournalism, which is something that I take up specifically in one of the essays, what that term means, or what I think that term means, which he identifies as, you know, none of the protocols that journalists use.
From Waiting for Tear Gas, White Globe to Black. The working idea was to move with the flow of protest from dawn to 3 a.m., if need be, taking in the lulls, the waiting, and the margins of events. The rule of thumb for this sort of anti-photojournalism: no flash, no telephoto zoom lens, no gas mask, no autofocus, no press pass, and no pressure to grab at all costs the one defining image of dramatic violence. Later, working at the light table and reading the increasingly stereotypical descriptions of the new face of protest, I realized all the more that a simple descriptive physiognomy was warranted. The alliance on the streets was indeed stranger, more varied, and inspired than could be conveyed by cute alliterative play with Teamsters and Turtles. Something very simple is missed by descriptions of this as a movement founded in cyberspace. The human body asserts itself in the city streets, against the abstraction of global capital. There was a strong feminist dimension to this testimony, and there was also a dimension grounded in the experience of work. It was the men and women who work on the docks, after all, who shut down the flow of metal boxes from Asia, relying on individual knowledge that there is always another body on the other side of the sea doing the same work, that all this global trade is more than a matter of a mouse click.
So a very specific understanding of street photography, of being close up, of being kind of in the mix. And then the work itself is a slide sequence of a series of 80 or 81 photographs that is shown in a slide sequence under very specific rules at certain distance with a darkened room, and includes a short text that he writes about his decision to make these photographs and what he was trying to do. And in some way, some of the photographs are, they're just that, pictures of people in the street protesting, although it has this very specific frame of two globes that he has. So the subtitle of the work is White Globe to Black, and the work begins with a photograph of a white globe and then closes with a photograph of a black globe, although it's a loop. So, whether you want to say opens and closes is another kind mm-hmm. of question. It keeps, you know, you keep, it keeps turning in a certain kind of way.
It's interesting that the globe, I think you point out too, that the picture, the original, or again, the white globe picture includes the black globe.
Yeah.
And the black globe picture has just the black globe. Like it's a tighter shot on the black globe and excludes the white globe.
These are shots that are taken in a library space. So it's again, going inside versus, you know, the whole work is about being in the street and being outside, but going into a kind of quiet space. But he also shoots them so that you see those kind of library lights just kind of flooding down.
Yeah, it is a beautiful frame, right? It's a simple one, but using a picture, it allows you to sort of think about it in a different way, perhaps. But I think you made it much more clear to me with the idea of it being in a library space, right? The idea that you're going to now take these photographs that were taken in the experience, right, in the moment of this protest that is now historicized, as you say, and to historicize anything, it has to be the past, right? So you have to be able to look at it, and then you have to be able to tell a story at it. And here are two ways to narrate the past of the history, you know, of the globe, of the world, and globes themselves are historicizing elements too, right?
Yeah.
Maps are contentious all the time, right? So
you could say that there's no kind of complete finished work, because the map then takes you to the sea trade, to fish stories, to the ways in which, you know, borders are carved up and created, you know. So he's constantly, each work kind of moves on to the next one and refers back to ones before.
And was it first an installation then?
Yeah. So it's installed. There are five versions of it, collected or, you know, owned by different European, mostly European museums. So Tate has one, and that's how this project started. Mm-hmm. And then he has on, I think, one or two other, well, it was published, part of the photographs were published in a text around Seattle, 5 days that shook the world, that was published in 2000. But it's not the exact same photographs in Waiting for Tear Gas, and not, it's only 32 of them. And then occasionally in other works, he has included them. And that's interesting as well, because he's, for him, and, you know, one of the important things about his work is that it's not just about sequence, but it's, you know, about context. It's about what you put next to something, and not just like what photograph you put next to another photograph, but what work you're putting in dialogue with other works that create new kinds of histories. So he's very careful and conscious of thinking about, you know, where Waiting for Tear Gas would go.
Well, it's a pretty impressive, like, again, just the opportunity to talk to you about it and read your piece and to look at it as well, and to see it in context of Titanic's wake also, you know, as you say, keeps opening up these possibilities of understanding. And it's one of those important things, again, that I think we, in particular, maybe with photography, but I assume this is generally maybe a human brain issue or a training issue, perhaps, but the wish to sort of settle on meaning, right, is kind of stuck with us in many ways. And it's part of what he's fighting against. And I think it's within this context that you might sort of examine that sort of push against the iconic image. And I do want you to talk more about anti-photojournalism as well. Again, I do like that he's sort of critiquing the ways that we get these ideas about what photojournalism should be, what journalism should be, you know, all these kinds of things, and then trying to understand what its antithesis might be. We have to have a definition to have an anti-definition.
So, I mean, the iconic in many ways goes back to what I was just saying about thinking about sequence and essays. He calls his work photo essays, or he sometimes calls them disassembled movies, or at least Aerospace Folktales, the term that he used to describe that was a disassembled movie. And so he's thinking about, you know, pieces and parts and the ways in which images go together. And in that way, it is a resistance or a kind of refusal to think about, you know, the shot, the kind of totalizing shot that encapsulates everything. But also, I think more than, and that is part of what he's doing in Waiting for Tear Gas, because this idea that you can, you know, encapsulate the protester as a kind of stereotype of, you know, that there is a stereotype of the protester that circulates in the press. He's obviously, you know, he's pushing a back against this in multiple ways with the types of photographs he takes, but also with the number of them that you need, you know, that you have many of them, they go in a loop and you're going to continue to kind of interact with these different faces. But he's also pushing back again, and this comes up in his discussion in the introduction to Photography Against the Grain, about these kind of assumptions about we have about what the medium of photography is.
Perhaps it is significant that I began, innocently enough, by looking at published photographs and not at museologically preserved specimens. Thus, I was more quickly impressed than might otherwise have been the case by the extreme degree to which photographic meaning was dependent on context. Here was a visual art for which, unlike cinema, discontinuity and incompletion seemed fundamental, despite attempts to construct reassuring notions of organic unity and coherence at the level of the single image. Thus, the problem of reception, the problem of what Walter Benjamin termed the afterlife of the work of art, becomes especially important for photography. And thus, also the category of the author is especially fragile and subject to editorial revision.
We have this assumption that, you know, there is a kind of singular image, or that it's a stop in time, but actually, you know, the medium, you know, does everything to kind of drive against that. But we want to make it this kind of iconic image or this kind of singular image. And so much work is pushing back against, or not necessarily pushing back, but asking us to rethink those assumptions we have about photography. And that, again, goes back to this question of the way in which photography is institutionalized within, you know, as a work of art, as a framed object that goes on the wall. And he's, you know, really interested in rethinking the way in which we've thought about photography in that way. It's not anti-aesthetic or anti-art, but it is, does photography, you know, should photography be historicized in the same ways that we historicize other objects and images, or, you know, are we putting that on the media?
Let's take another break with the Cinematic Orchestra's Every Day. Stay with us on Interchange for Shooting the Gulf, Alan Sekula in the American Grain.
Welcome back. I'm Doug Storm on Interchange.
The Critical Investigation of Photography and Its Uses and Misuses is our topic today. Stephanie Schwartz of University College London joined us via Skype to talk about the work of the late Alan Sekula.
The interesting thing in that, in one of those pieces in Focus for the Tate, you point out in particular how iconic images replace sort of other narrative photo essays, photo narratives about things, right? I think one in particular was a Vietnam photo series of what was happening in the war, and it sort of becomes singular in one iconic photo of a troop. The same thing with the Vietnam War. We sort of bring that to the. I think there are a couple photographs you talk about. The one where a general. Someone he's interrogating, I think. I forget the names. And then the very famous naked little girl photograph. And these things actually replace our thinking of the events. You know, that photography can help us think about events if we're not sort of narrowed to this one image. It seems to me that that iconography, the iconic, serves the neoliberal agenda as well, right? It serves history being frozen and stop being thought about.
Right, so that you could write the story and you know the end and there is an end, or, you know, and you can kind of narrate that. I mean, so that kind of feeds into this question about what anti-photojournalism is and how he frames it. Because I feel like one of the things that I was trying to do with specifically that essay in the piece was really to kind of think seriously about what he meant by that term and not just have a kind of, well, it's anti-photo, you know, what it is. It's anti-photojournalism. It's a critique of mass media. It's a critique of the way in which photojournalism, or what we could, you know, larger, not just photography, but other, the media in general, has framed specifically something like protest, so that you get, you know, to use the stereotypical terms like the hooligan, the kind of hooded figure, the, you know, black hood with face masks, these kinds of things. So on the one hand, he is pushing back against that. But I think he's also, you know, or what I argue in that text is that he's asking us to kind of also think about our assumptions about what we think photojournalism is, and kind of go back and think about the history of photojournalism such that we don't close photojournalism down, because actually in its early moments, or in its at its height, and when it was emerging in the 20s and 30s, at least in, you know, Europe and the United States, it was, you know, seen as had an amazing political potential for information, communication, news, radical politics. And so what he's doing in that work is not just kind of offering critique of photojournalism, but he's again asking us to think historically and remind ourselves of the way in which the narrative about photojournalism has been written in such that we want to kind of push back against it. You know, one of the things he's kind of critiquing, again, to go back to the neoliberal point, is, you know, these kinds of new media outlets which kind of privilege immediacy and privilege kind of being there. But for him, he's also, you know, very careful, or very, it's important to remind us that those are kind of mythologies as well, that create this idea of like the individual voice, the witness. And, you know, he's someone who's more interested in the collective and collective practice.
And you do stress the again, I hate to do it, but I keep wanting to stress the waiting part and stress the reflection, you know, that comes from viewing anyone's work, right? So, you know, the myth of as you say, immediacy, the myth of being able to understand the event in the particular, right? Or to even understand it in the broader sense, right? These both confound each other. One of the things that that I think was fascinating about that as well is that you point to the images that become frozen and represent things, right? So the Seattle protests over the WTO become represented by the black block, because that's the picture that gets shown, that's the story that gets told. Breaking a window is an issue, you know, property is being damaged, and these are dangerous, again, as you say, hooligans, you know, and Sekula's work shows the variety of protest, right? The variety of people, the variety of interests that are involved in it, the ways in which people are working together, and they're not singular, and they're not like one anarchist group out to destroy the world, which is how media tends to present it. It struck me even more when I think about, you know, remembering how the media gave it a tagline too, right? The battle in Seattle, which is ridiculous. Yeah. But it's like the Ali Frazier fight in 75 was called the Thriller in Manila, you know,
right.
And it's got the same ring to it, right? It's like, it seems to me an intentional echo where you just, it's just an event and we put it in the history pages, or we can put it on a baseball card later, you know, some kind of thing in which you just, oh, the battle in Seattle. Yeah.
Yeah. But also sealing that up in a certain kind of way. This is what it is.
Right.
And so, yeah, as you say, I mean, one of the, you know, part of what he's doing in that work is giving you the multiple, one of the most important things that historians and critics have written about that protest is one of the most interesting things about it, or one of the most important things about it that made it kind of singular, even though it was part of a larger series of protests that, you know, around the WTO or against the WTO, was that it was became incredibly evident how many different types of protesters or activists there was. And there wasn't a sense that it was just, you know, labor or just the environment, that the one of his agendas was to kind of bring out those kind of quote unquote faces of protest in a certain kind of way. So that as one, even though because they become photographed and they are singular photographs, one of the things that I was thinking about was that they become kind of stereotypes. So you still have the kind of hippie and the hooligan, if those are the words that I use in quotations to kind of, but that as one slips into the next, you realize that one kind of fades into the other, and it's about that kind of movement between them, and that it's not about the, you know, the stasis of that image.
The Traffic in Photographs, 1981. How can we work towards an active, critical understanding of the prevailing conventions of representation, particularly those surrounding photography? The discourse that surrounds photography speaks paradoxically of discipline and freedom, of rigorous truths and unleashed pleasures. Here then, at least by virtue of a need to contain the tensions inherent in this paradox, is the site of a certain shell game, a certain dance, even a certain politics. In effect, we are invited to dance between photographic truths and photographic pleasures with very little awareness of the floorboards and muscles that make this seemingly effortless movement possible.
In a way, the slide sequence was part of that, but also, as you're suggesting, that kind of, you know, doing away with or pushing back against that conceit that you know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this has a narrative story and you know what's going to end. There's a battle and there's like a success or failure. Whereas he gives you a loop and he times it and you have to kind of wait for the next slide to drop, but the next slide doesn't necessarily give you any conclusions or finality. It just goes to the next one and then you start over again.
Yeah, it opens up possibilities. That's to me the fascinating thing about it. It's firmly in an American trend, or in a trend, sort of the American, it's not against the grain of American thinking, I should say, in some ways, right? So there is, in Emerson's famous self-reliance, there's, you know, life only avails not to having lived, power exists in the, you know, the instant, you know, from one point to another. I'm mangling that quote, of course, but that the power is in the gap. And that's Emerson's perspective in that particular essay as well, that, you know, there is more than the narrative, the myth, the story that's closed. And Emerson famously shuffled all his essay pieces around constantly, right? So he's the sort of philosopher of the sentence. It's the tension between the sentences that create the meaning in much of what Emerson says. And to me, Sekula is right in the line of that kind of thinking.
And I guess go back to just what you were saying, kind of reminded me of another point about the kind of anti-photojournalism in relation to the iconic and the kind of also anti-narrative, if you want to kind of think about it that way, is that it's not, so on the one hand, it is obviously a kind of response to the way in which the media has represented these protesters, but it's an incredible engagement with that as well, and the kind of importance of media. So it's never just a kind of shutting down or a kind of anti in that kind of way. He's really thinking about this kind of opening up as well. And one of the things, like, the more and more time I spent with the work, it became obvious, or you began to see the kind of almost play with media, where you would see, like, you know, just like the lens of a foot of the camera kind of jutting into the frame. So it's a kind of self-reference on the fact that this is not, you know, this is still a representation. It's not as if you're, you know, going to get the whole story again, or, mm-hmm. you know, if I do a kind of anti-media, I'm giving you some kind of truth in that kind of way. Or the great, there's one at the end where he, or not at the, it's the, in the end of one of my pieces where he has that shot of kind of Ted Koppel kind of reporting from mm-hmm. waiting for tear gas. So it's like the story is already being written in the media, kind of unfolding within his story, in which he's kind of working through the way in which the media then tells its story. And so there's this constant, you know, kind of play on that, which is actually part of the history of documentary. We have this idea that, you know, there was this high moment of documentary in the 1930s in which photographs were, you know, attempting to have some objective record of what was happening. But actually, if you begin again to look closer, which I think is what he's actually instructing us to do in some of his essays about documentary, back at the 1920s and 30s, what you see is that, you know, the kind of engagement with media and mediation, with text and image, it's all there. It's not been historicized that way. We've been trained not to see it. Mm-hmm. The kind of meta critique that he's doing at the same time is part of the practice. Mm-hmm.
Here's a final break. Once more accompanied by the cinematic orchestra. This is Man with the Movie Camera. When we return, what follows in the Titanic's wake? Stay with us for more Interchange. Welcome back. I'm Doug Storm on Interchange. We'll close this glance at the work of Alan Sekulow with a look at two kings of the world, Bill Gates and James Cameron. And we'll circle back to the beginning. November 30, 1999. Dear Bill Gates, I swam past your dream house the other day, but didn't stop to knock. Frankly, your underwater sensors had me worried. I would have liked to take a look at Winslow Homer's Lost on the Grand Banks. It's a great painting, but speaking as a friend and fellow citizen, at $30 million, you paid too much. Highest price ever paid for an American painting. So why are you so interested in a picture of two poor, lost dory fishermen? Momentarily high on a swell, peering into a wall of fog. They're about as high as they're ever going to be, unless the sea gets uglier. They're going to die, you know, and it won't be a pretty death. And as for you, Bill, when you're on the net, are you lost or found? And the rest of us, lost or found, are we on it or in it? your friend.
I do want to talk about the Dear Bill Gates triptych and the letter written as well. So if, you know, at least just kind of describe it and give a little bit to it, because it's, one, it's pretty funny, and two, it's not funny. So if you don't mind, let's talk about that.
Dear Bill Gates is one of the works that's part of Titanic's Wake, which is a project that he did in... Well, it has a book project and an exhibition, 2001, 2003. Mm-hmm. So it included Waiting for Tear Gas, a work called The Titanic's Wake and Dear Bill Gates. And Dear Bill Gates, so it's a triptych of, it's a photograph and of him kind of swimming in front of Bill Gates' home, as well as a letter that he writes to Gates about his purchase of Winslow Homer's painting of two fishermen lost on the Grand Banks, which sold for, you know, a record figure.
$30 million, I think.
Yeah, at that time. Mm-hmm. And so he puts the photograph of his home, Sekula himself kind of peering out of the water, and then a photograph of boats or fishermen along with this letter. And so he's doing a lot of the things that he does in his work. There's always more than one photograph. There's text along with image. And as well, this is part of an essay that he wrote that is the sequel, one could say, to a very important essay that he wrote called The Traffic in Photographs, which he rewrites in relation to the internet and thinking about questions of neoliberalism and circulation in that context. And so he has an extended kind of commentary on this work, Dear Bill Gates. But what's also interesting and why it's important to go that it goes along with the Waiting for Tear Gas is that the letter is dated November 30th, 1999, which mm-hmm. is the day of the protest. And so again, he's kind of syncing all of these things kind of back together in a certain one way.
Right. But so Bill Gates is in the center of, I mean, Bill Gates is Seattle, right? So
yeah, he's in the center of Seattle. But then he's also in the center of art and photography. And, you know, one of the questions that he poses in a lot of his writing is kind of posing these questions rhetorically, but kind of driving an argument, you know, what does Bill Gates want with this Winslow Homer painting of two fishermen? And then you all of a sudden start to call up the stories of fish story and fishermen and labor and the sea and the, you know, of someone who's so far removed from those kinds of spaces. So what does it mean to kind of own a representation of that is some of, you know, what he's trying to get in. Mm-hmm. One of the things about Sekula that's all, you know, he has these figures that become these kind of, there's Bill Gates, there's Frank Gehry, and there's Edward Steichen, are these figures that he continuously returns to and mobilizes his critiques around the ways in which histories have been written, neoliberalism, through those figures. And so Bill Gates kind of functions in that context as well. For him.
Yeah, it's interesting because just the way you described it and the way you described your own analogizing reading of it, right? And the intentions and sort of the internal allusions to his own work and then the other work that he speaks to as well. I used fecund before. I'm not sure there's a better word for it. It just keeps, you know, burgeoning and blossoming into new ideas, right?
Yeah, but I like the humor point. Like I'm glad you.
Well, it's a hard, like, I don't, so I've watched The Forgotten Space. I've dipped in and out of multiple texts, and his writing is humorous frequently.
Yeah.
And you know, I haven't found humor in his photographs that I've seen.
You could say that This Ain't China, which is another one of the early works, these photo essays. So there's Aerospace Folk Tales and the Untitled Side Sequence, but then there's This Ain't China, which is a kind of performance / kind of theater around the working conditions in a kind of pizza restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an early film called Performance Under Working Conditions, which is also quite funny. That's almost kind of a Chaplin-esque kind of slapstick.
Mm-hmm.
2 meetings for one place.
Sneeze on this spaghetti. Sneeze on it. That's for blinking.
Okay, that's out.
Just take this Lincoln's table, man. Take it right now. Just take it.
That's a snot deluxe special.
Like Barry Wayne said when he was working in where he was working.
Yeah.
Cyan Hall Smith came in.
Oh, yeah?
He spit. No, he put booger.
You know what John Chin?
Logies.
Swear to God.
Yeah.
You know what Chin did in the cafeteria when me and Chin worked at UCSD?
Yeah, that was even true.
In the cafeteria.
Yeah.
One of the UC Regents was coming to dinner.
Uh-huh.
So me and Chin were working. Chin was going to be like the waiter for the luncheon. It was luncheon, right? You know.
Did he have a wig?
No. You could have long hair then. Or maybe he had short hair. I can't remember. We used to wear like hair nets and shit.
Mm-hmm.
No, you could have long hair then. That's right. Most days. I can't remember.
Where was it? At the cafeteria?
Yeah, at Revel.
Okay.
So Chin had about 5 tabs acid, man. Just, and he was going to drop it in the dude's coffee, but he never got a chance.
Who was the guy?
Some big, I don't know, DeWitt Higgs or something.
Who's that?
He's the guy that's San Diego Regent.
God.
Man, imagine if we filled this food with mescaline or something.
Well, we could do it.
I don't like that. How about if we just, you know, came in and carved hammers and sickles in the tables?
This is Interchange. Our guest is Stephanie Schwartz, lecturer at University College London on American documentary and photography. And our topic is the work of photographer and essayist Alan Sekula. From Titanic's Wake. The lugubrious arrogance of Titanic intrigues me. Is it a symptom of something larger? We peer morbidly into the vortex of industrialism's early nosedive into the abyss. The film absolves us of any obligation to remember the disasters that followed. Quick as a wink, cartoon-like, the angel of history is flattened between a wall of steel and a wall of ice. It's an easy, premature way to mourn a bloody century. Or maybe, more innocently, the movie is a bellwether of good-hearted American neoliberalism. When James Cameron accepted the first of his Academy Awards for the film, he thrust his Oscar statuette into the overheated air above the podium and bellowed out a line from the film, "King of the World." Later, looking slightly abashed after receiving what seemed to be a scathing glance from his wife, he asked for a moment of silence for the long-dead passengers and crew. The idea of Titanic's Wake is sort of the reality, the material reality of the filming, you know, is more important, is what Sekula does all across his work, is to say, this is the thing that's the illusion, right? This is the illusion that gets historicized or becomes the historicizing act, the historicizing element that you then think that this is the world, this is how the world happened. But within the creating of that narrative is a fact of material destruction, you know, material degradation, the way the actual world works economically, hierarchically, in class ways, you know, this, you have to actually know how it's composed. And the story of building that tank to film the Titanic and multiple other pieces, apparently, like to supposed to film 20 other movies there or something like that. So do you mind really quick just kind of talking about the material fact of that production?
Yeah. So when he was, you know, again, as you're saying, the work is, again, it's kind of, it's mediated in the sense that it's Titanic's Wake is about the movie Titanic. So he's already thinking about the multiple possibilities of the way in which someone could have told that story. And here's the way James Cameron told it as a love story. But he also then, as you say, kind of just gets down to this kind of basic fact that the film site was built in Mexico because obviously lower wages, which is part of what he's talking about in terms of his understanding of globalization and neoliberalism, and that the organization, you know, the setting up of that site basically devastated the muscle gathering livelihood, you know, as he puts it, of the villagers who were working there, because it actually, the tank lowered the salinity of the tidal pools and changed the ways in which, like, literally the environment was working. And then that just happens, and then you leave and you produce this movie. And so for him, he's, you know, those, that kind of juxtaposition is what's so important for, you know, to kind of think about and bring into these stories.
Mm-hmm.
So literally living in the wake of that
Right.
Movie, not in the wake of the Titanic.
Yeah, right. But the Titanic, is sunk, and in the Titanic, in this sense, sinks other things.
Yeah.
So
it is about that. It is also about the Titanic in terms of the kind of, what it stood for as well at that moment. But, it's always through so many different lenses.
Yeah. It's multi-referential all the time. I think you use the word multivalence. It's, that's what's beautiful, too. No, it's fascinating. I'm so happy to have stumbled across Alan Sekulah and your work as well. And I want to thank you very much for your time. I know it was a long time, and I appreciate you hanging in there with me. And
it's great. I always enjoy talking about his work. I think it's very approachable, and as you say, kind of you see it and it kind of draws you in that kind of way, and then you want to kind of learn more, and once you see that the works all start to begin to relate to each other, you start to have this archive of information.
Well, Stephanie Schwartz, thanks for joining me on Interchange.
You're welcome. Thank you.
My heart is full to bursting, except to say I'm the king of the world.
That's our show. I'm compelled to close with Dan Burns, King of the World. Our thanks to Stephanie Schwartz for introducing us to the great Alan Sekulah, an artist and thinker deeply in the American grain of Emerson and Melville, a mode perhaps best described by the poets William Carlos Williams and Susan Howe. I'm Doug Storm. Thanks for listening. I produce Interchange, and on this show, you can blame me for editing, mixing, and music selection as well. Assistant producer is Rob Schoon, and our executive producer is Wes Martin. Stay tuned for the Jazz Menagerie, coming up next on WFHB.
I am the king of the world. It could have been you, but it's me. I'm surprised you didn't hear about it. It was on the cover of Newsweek, November 1993. As king of the world, I'll occasionally go to China. Visit you guys. You don't have to be afraid. I don't need you to bow down. I'm not God, I'm just a king, I realize. Well, it might be kind of nice, though, if you kiss my feet and call me all-knowing leader of men. If you were king of the world, I'm sure you'd want the same for your.
King.